Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in the City of Musty against Aladdin's Castle Incorporated. Whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, the primary question in this case is whether or not the playing of coin-operated machines is a fundamental right. There are other questions, of course. The second important question is which rules of law are applicable to adults and which are applicable to children. With your permission, I'd like to discuss the fundamental right question first. We think in finding a fundamental right on par with freedom of speech and religion, right to travel, and other important rights, that the Court of Appeals used an extremely broad interpretation of the term association. Of course, in its broadest terms, association would encompass all commercial transactions. We realize that. If you rent an automobile, of course, there may be some associational aspects. If you rent a boat, if you rent a motel room, you may have guests in it.
Well, if you associate together to fix prices, I suppose that's freedom of association.
Yes. What we're saying is that you can't just take the term association in its ordinary sense and apply it as the association that is protected by the Constitution. We feel that there's something more than just mere physical proximity to constitute association protected by the Constitution. For instance, if you go in a bank to make a loan, you're going to talk with people. You're going to meet friends and acquaintances. When you go in the supermarket, when you're at work, you have association with your fellow workers. But these are all matters governed by the law of contract. And I'd like to discuss for just a moment the nature of the transaction that is regulated. What we have here is a simple rental agreement. Generally, a customer pays 25 cents for use of a machine, generally from 1 to 3 minutes or whatever time it takes. No different from renting a lawnmower or renting a power saw or any other machine. Now, if this type of transaction is the association that's protected by the Constitution under the decisions of this court, then every commercial transaction known to man becomes a First Amendment activity. This, we feel, will weaken the values that have traditionally been upheld by this court. Going to the question of which rules of law are applicable to adults and which are applicable to children, we say children are simply not the same as adults. We don't mean to imply that children have no constitutional rights. Certainly they do. But the rights of children are not always the same as the rights of adults. I think, in the words of Justice Frankfurter's concurring opinion in May versus Anderson, he says it much better than I can. Children have a very special place in life which law should reflect. Legal theories and their phrasing in other cases readily lead to fallacious reasoning if uncritically transferred to determination of a state's duty toward children. As we read the opinion of the Court of Appeals, we feel that the Court of Appeals has relied upon cases that are good cases, but they're cases dealing with something other than children. They deal with race. They deal with adults. They deal in suspect areas. They deal with the right to decide whether or not to bear a child. but they don't deal with the facts at hand. Therefore, we feel that these cases are inapplicable.
Mr. Archer, is it the city's position that playing these games is per se harmful to children?
No, I don't think that's our position. That may be correct, but I don't know that that's our position. I don't know that we have evidence to that effect. We think that playing the machines in the actual setting in which it takes place in many cases is harmful. Not in every case. We don't claim that in every case there's harm, but we also say that we cannot tailor a law that will fit every establishment in town. There's just no way it can be done.
Well, is the age matter still in this case?
Yes. In fact, we consider the age question
the paramount question.
We do have a question regarding some language in the ordinance, but
let me ask you: wasn't the ordinance declared unconstitutional on both state and federal grounds?
On the language part.
On the age part.
No, the state court has never reviewed the age question. Or, I'm sorry, maybe I misunderstood your question.
Well, I thought the claim was being made in this case by your colleague that we can't reach the age issue because it was declared unconstitutional under the state constitution.
Oh, I understand. I thought you meant
well,
the state
court.
Well,
what about that?
All right. The provision of the state constitution is identical to the federal constitution. The words may be slightly different, but there's no.
Well, so what if they are? But it was nevertheless held that the state constitution invalidated this provision.
Well, but that's not an independent state ground.
Why isn't it independent?
Well, because it's identical. In other words, if a state adopted a constitution,
well, you wouldn't say that the state courts. Would you say the state courts have a rule that they will always interpret their constitutional provision identically with the federal? Is there such a rule?
Texas has such a rule.
So they're just forbidden to independently to construe their own constitution?
Oh, I don't think they're forbidden to, but I think since they are similar and since they were patterned after the federal constitution.
Well, I know, but would you say that it would be a departure from the regular Texas rule if the Texas court said, well, I know the federal courts are holding, would permit this kind of an ordinance, but we just construe our Constitution differently.
Yes, I think that would be a substantial departure because one Constitution is patterned after the other, and the cases construing one are authority for the other, and that is the rule of law in Texas. And I think I've covered that in my brief, but I can go into that further if you'd like.
Well, here, in any event, the holding that both the federal and state constitutional provisions were violated was a holding in the Fifth Circuit, wasn't it?
Yes, Your
Honor. Not of any Texas court.
No, that's correct.
So does that make a difference on whether or not this rests on an adequate state ground?
I don't think so, because, again, I think the Fifth Circuit was simply stating that the two constitutions were identical and that, of course, if it violated one, it would obviously violate the other.
Well, to the extent that the judgment rests on a holding that it violates the state constitution, what's the case doing here?
Well, again, I don't think it's an independent state ground. I think that they are identical. The state constitution and the federal constitution mean exactly the same thing. So you couldn't have a federal question without it also. I mean, you couldn't have a violation of the federal constitution without it also violating the state constitution. But I don't think that is the meaning of the jurisdictional statute. I don't think
it's. Well, you're not suggesting, are you, that if indeed you had a Texas state court determination of a state constitutional question, solely based on the state constitutional question, But that would raise a federal question because the state constitutional provision was the same as the federal constitution?
Oh, no. I think the state court would have to actually rule on a federal question before it could come to this court, obviously.
Well, how about a federal court? Would an action lie under any of the jurisdictional provisions for federal courts to invalidate an ordinance such as this on the grounds that it violated the constitution of a state?
Well, in a diversity case, yes.
Was this case a diversity?
Yes, this was a diversity case. But again, the federal question, the federal rule of law involved is the application of the strict scrutiny test. Now, that is not a state question. There is no state rule of law to that effect. The Court of Appeals, even in their discussion of the, quote, rational basis, first found that there was a fundamental right, that of association, and then reasoned backward by placing the burden of proof on the city, saying the city failed to produce evidence to show this and that. Therefore, throughout the opinion, and I realize that we're not appealing from the opinion, we're appealing from the judgment, but I think the judgment is incorrect because of a body of federal law that the Court of Appeals misapplied, not any state law. There's no state law, strict scrutiny test versus rational basis test doctrine. Looking at the application of law to children, I think the Court of Appeals improperly applied rules of law pertaining to adults or to race and other matters instead of confining it to children. Obviously, children do not have all the rights that adults have. Children do not choose their domicile. They do not choose the school they wish to attend. They not in all cases choose the church that they wish to attend. And while this may be considered private action, it is buttressed at every point by state action. For instance, if a child refuses to reside in the domicile chosen by his parents, he's treated by the state as a runaway. If he refuses to attend the school that his parents choose, he's treated as a truant. If he refuses to do the other things that his parents require him to do, the state makes an exception and allows physical punishment that wouldn't be permissible toward an adult. Of course, many states require a parent's signature for the issuance of a driver's license. Others require a parent's signature for a minor to marry. This is all state action. Of course, there are countless other things in which the state buttresses the action of the parent in not allowing the same rights to minors as adults. I think the failure of the Court of Appeals to give considerations to these facts is what caused the improper judgment.
Well, this ordinance, I gather, does make the distinction, doesn't it, between this kind of entertainment center and other centers where teenagers gather?
This ordinance itself does not. This ordinance simply does not deal with those other questions. But this court has said many times that we were not required to address all the ills existing in one law or one enactment. I don't think we single out any particular establishment and say this establishment cannot do this, but all others can. We just fail to say anything about the others.
Well, the ordinance does make a distinction, though, doesn't it, between teenagers who play these games and teenagers who are present in the same establishment?
Well, yes. The ordinance does not address the question of being present, but we don't deny that denying them the right to play the games will discourage their presence. We've never denied that.
What is the interest then of the city is trying to trying to achieve with the ordinance?
Well, I think it's twofold. I think the first is a financial impact. I think the city fathers feel that the children are spending money on these games that they can ill afford, money that they need.
To prevent the children from spending their money?
We think that that is one concern. I think another concern, and the concern that was emphasized by our police department, was some of the things that take place at these establishments, such as drug transfers, fights, contacts.
But the ordinance doesn't prevent them from going to the centers, right?
Not directly, but we assume they go there because they want to play the machines. I don't think they'd go there if they couldn't play the machines or not in any large number.
Mr. Archer, I want to be sure about a statement I thought you made. You take the position this ordinance is not directed at Aladdin's?
Well, no, it's directed at every establishment in the city. I mean,
isn't it really directed at Aladdin's, period?
No, we had this ordinance in 1973 before we'd ever heard of Aladdin's. Now, if they're talking about the amendment, the amendment probably affected Aladdin's and one other place in the city, Fun Fair, I believe, in another shopping center.
Well, I'm speaking of 1353.
Well,
enacted just 2 days after a significant event. No?
Yes, that ordinance, there had been a previous ordinance that made an exception to places located in a shopping center. Now, to the extent that it closed that loophole, if you may, then I guess it would be directed to all establishments in shopping center malls, which Aladdin's and I believe one other at that time were the only ones there. Now there are several. At that time, Aladdin's and one other was the only one. But now the age regulation that we're seeking to uphold applies to every establishment in town, the 7-Eleven stores that maybe only have one machine, and where there are no other customers present, where there's no association involved whatsoever.
Then you can't justify that on the fact that you don't want the children to go to these places where they have drug transactions.
No, I think of course, I say one, you know. I don't know that there's cases where there's never more than one present.
But your point is the ordinance applies to the 7-Eleven stores and hotel lobby and every place there's one of these.
Yes, and that would be based more on the financial impact. But I think most of the establishments have more than one machine, to be candid with you. But what I'm saying is that there doesn't have to be any association involved because it could just be one machine and it could just be one person present. And I don't know how you'd read association into that. Frankly, I don't know how you read association into 100 people being present unless they go there for a common purpose. They are acquainted with each other, or they become acquainted after they get there, or something.
Well, I wasn't really as concerned with the association point as the reason for the ordinance.
Well,
the reason for the ordinance has to be, I think, limited to the fact that you don't want the under 17-year-old to spend 25 cents without the consent of their parents, isn't it?
Well, unfortunately, that's the term that the appellee uses, spending 25 cents, but there's nothing in the record.
Well, over and over again, maybe they'll spend 25 cents.
Right. In other words, just like if you smoke one cigarette, you may smoke another cigarette. If you take one drink, you may take a lot of drinks.
Well, why doesn't that rationale apply to miniature golf courses and the like, then?
Well, I don't know that that we have negated regulation of miniature golf courses. This particular ordinance does not. But I don't think that we have said we do not have the power to regulate miniature golf courses. I can see distinctions. And again, the record is not as strong in this case. We thought we were trying it on the rational basis question rather than a higher level test. But officers can drive by and see people playing on a miniature golf course. They're exposed to public view at all times. I don't know how much difference that makes, but our police department says it makes a difference. Now, that's not in the record, and I don't know if I should even be saying it, but those are some of the things that could have been in the record had we known that we would be held to this type of
test.
Well,
I can understand that if you're talking about an amusement center, but the ordinance isn't limited to amusement centers. That's why I made the analogy to the miniature golf course. It seems to me it's amusement machines wherever located, 7-Eleven, hotel lobbies, pizza joint, whatever it might be.
Yes, I think where, like, just one machine is primarily the financial impact, but I think you'll find in most cases it'll be more than one machine. I don't think any of the places just have, well, they may be a few, but I think most of them have from two to four, you know, that are not arcades.
Council, do you have any doubt that a state or municipality could totally outlaw the use of coin-operated machines?
The state could, under the holding of this court, I believe, in Murphy versus California. The state has not seen fit to do so, and, of course, we're merely a part of the state, and until we are given permission by the state to totally outlaw them, I don't think we can. The state has given us permission to, quote, regulate.
But the Fifth Circuit didn't base its holding of unconstitutionality on the grounds that you had exceeded your power under state law, did it?
Well, to the extent that the state constitution is identical to the federal constitution, I guess I'd have to say yes, but I don't think they indicated that there was an independent state law ground, but merely that it was the same as the federal constitution.
Suppose over a period of time, counsel, the police reported to the authorities, the city council, that a great deal of drug traffic was taking place in three city parks, and there were only three city parks in the city. Council pass an ordinance saying that 17-year-olds could not be in the city parks?
I think we would be a lot closer then to what they're saying here. For one thing, when they go into the park, it's not a financial transaction. It's not a business matter. I think that is more closely akin to, say, being on the streets, a curfew. I doubt that we could. I think we could regulate our parks, and we certainly do regulate our parks, regardless of what anyone may say that we've neglected that area, but we do regulate our parks. I'd like to speak just a moment on the vagueness question. I think both the district court and the court of appeals fail to read the language connection to the criminal elements in the context in which it's used.
Has that provision been stricken from the ordinance?
It has, Your Honor, but we do agree with Appley that it's not moot. We would like to have it back.
Why isn't it moot? What controversy is there now about the...
Well, we would like to put it back in if this court sees fit to allow us to.
An advisory opinion from us on that?
Well...
Well, the ordinance just doesn't exist in the form that it was when this case began.
Well, that is correct, but it is...
And when the Court of Appeals rendered its judgment.
Yes, but it's only because we're not allowed to by the order of the district court, and then in turn which was made an order of the Court of Appeals.
Well, you were still appealing. You're the one who brought this case up, weren't you?
Well, we brought it from the
Court of Appeals to here.
Court of Appeals to here.
But meanwhile, you amended your ordinance.
Yes, we had already amended the ordinance because we were prohibited from using it.
Well, but so certainly you didn't have to amend the ordinance. You could simply comply with the Fifth Circuit's opinion and seek certiorari and get a judgment from this court. Seeking to overturn the Fifth Circuit.
Well, yes, but in the meantime, we would have other applications, and it would be unclear as to what the status of these applications were.
If you thought you had to obey the order, you didn't need to repeal the ordinance to do it. You could just not have enforced it. That particular criminal elements provision.
That is correct. I realize we could. We felt at the time that was the best thing to do. But as I say, we would like to reinstate it if this court should find either that the appellee had no standing to question the language or that the language is not vague or both. The reason we say they have no standing, in the context in which this is used, this is not a standard for upon which a license is granted. The standard upon which a license is granted is good character. This is simply a direction to the chief of police as to how he is to gather certain intelligence. No different from Laird versus Tatum.
Is there any dispute about that, Mr. Archer? From the other side, your present analysis, that it is directed to the chief of police?
Yes, they claim that, because it is directed toward the chief of police, that his recommendation in turn will influence the city manager, which in turn will influence the city council and the district court and ad infinitum. We also say, of course, in the context in which it's used, it's not unconstitutionally vague because nobody has to know what it means except the chief of police, and he obviously knows what it means. There's no further question. I save the rest of it.
Well, I can ask your other side. Where is the principal place of business of the FLE?
The home office, Chicago.
All right, thanks. Thank you.
So, Mr. Cohn.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. With the court's permission, I would like to first address the matter of the existence of independent state grounds for the decision. The judgment of the Court of Appeals on the age restriction claim is supported not only by the federal constitutional grounds, but by independent state law grounds. The court expressly held that the ordinance violated the equal protection and due process clauses of the Texas Constitution.
Well, Mr. Thorne, suppose that the only claim that you had made or that your client had made in the federal district court was under the laws of Texas. Now, certainly in a diversity suit, there would be jurisdiction.
Yes.
And certainly the Court of Appeals could have reviewed it.
That's correct.
And certainly we could review it here.
You could on certiorari, Your Honor.
Yes.
The problem here is that this is here on appeal under Section 1254.
Did you say it's an improper appeal?
No, not so long
so
as this
the
court
limits. So the adequate state ground argument is a jurisdictional argument?
Yes, it's a jurisdictional argument, and it centers.
But we surely have jurisdiction in a diversity case to pass on state law questions. We hardly ever do. I don't know that since I've been here where we've ever.
Your Honor is quite right. The mechanism by which you would reach the state law question, I submit, would be to dismiss the appeal under 1254-2 and treat the jurisdictional statement as a petition for
cert. Why is that? In a diversity case, the Court of Appeals has stricken down a state law.
Right.
Now, why isn't it a proper appeal here?
It is a proper appeal, but Section 1254-2 provides specifically that in such an appeal, the review on appeal shall be restricted to the federal questions presented. So Congress in 1254-2 has prohibited the court from considering the state grounds.
I see. So we could. So, but if we dismissed it, the appeal, and granted cert?
Then, Your Honor, it's good. In fact, if the appeal is dismissed, the appropriate procedure, according to Stern and Gressman, and I think that's correct, would be to treat the jurisdictional statement as a petition for certiorari under 2103, which commands the court to do that.
Well, don't you want it both ways, though? You don't want us to consider that to be able to reach the state ground here, but you want to use the state ground to say we shouldn't reach anything.
Well, I want to rely on the state grounds, Your Honor, because I believe we're entitled to
avoid reaching any ground. To say that we haven't any jurisdiction?
No, I say you don't have jurisdiction on appeal. I say also that you do have jurisdiction if you choose to exercise it to grant certiorari.
But then have we not, on granting certiorari, on treating it as a cert, denied on the grounds that it was supported by an adequate state grounds?
Adequacy in that sense, Your Honor, simply means that it is sufficient to support the judgment if correct. It doesn't mean that you have reviewed the merits of the state ground. The point I make is illustrated, if the Court please, by the Hastings case, in which Chief Justice Hughes addressed this very point in the context of a statute allowing an appeal by the government from an order dismissing an indictment, where the indictment where the order held the indictment invalid either on the ground of the invalidity of the underlying statute or the construction of the statute on which the indictment was based. And the Chief Justice said in that case that the Court should first examine whether there was an independent ground for the order of the district court. If there was an independent ground that didn't relate to either the validity of the statute or the construction of the statute, he said the Court would be rendering an advisory opinion by ruling on the questions that were appealable. And he said that review of a judgment we cannot disturb because it rests on grounds we cannot examine would be an anomaly. And then he used as an analogy the appeal statute, which provides for appeal from the highest court of a state. And he said the practice of this court with respect to such appeals, when there is an independent state ground on which the judgment, which adequately supports the judgment, to dismiss the appeal.
Do you think Cox Broadcasting has changed that analysis at all?
I do not think it has, Your Honor. I believe, as I said, Stern and Gressman's position is consistent with mine, and I think that's a correct reading of it. It seems to me the analysis has to be that way. We are, as the appellee, we're entitled to rely on the whatever state grounds are available to support the judgment. We are entitled to rely on state grounds even though the Court of Appeals didn't rule on them. And yet, when it comes up here under 1254-2, we would be precluded from relying upon state grounds that support the judgment because this court is not allowed to examine those grounds under this proviso of 1254-2 that we've been talking about.
Do you think the proper disposition is if we happen to agree with you, to dismiss the appeal and then treating it as a cert to deny cert, dismiss it?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Dismiss it as improvidently granted.
Well, yes, Your Honor.
Yes, but we just deny it.
Would be denied. You're right. Yes, Your Honor is correct. The correct disposition, in our view, would be to dismiss the appeal, to treat the jurisdictional statement as a petition for certiorari, and deny certiorari on the ground that there are adequate state grounds.
But, Mr. Town, that means that we just have no jurisdiction to grant the cert and decide and review the question of state law.
Well, yes. No, it doesn't, Your Honor.
It doesn't?
Because you could elect, in your discretion, if you chose to do so, the case is properly in the federal courts as a diversity case, and this court has discretion to review state questions that come up that way if it chooses to do so. As Mr. Justice White pointed out, it rarely, if ever, does, but it would have authority to do that under its certiorari jurisdiction.
And you urge, in this case, what?
Deny it. Just deny cert.
Yes, just deny cert.
Mm-hmm. And if we disagree and grant it, then we go on and review the state law question.
If you disagreed and granted cert, then I submit to the court that you would and should review the state law question because
Also, could we not, if we took it as a cert, I understand your argument, we must dismiss the appeal, but if we took it as a cert, could we not do what we did in the Ohio Zucchini case and say, well, the state and federal law is parallel? And we will decide the federal question and send it back to the Court of Appeals to review the state law question in the light of what we say about the federal law. We'd have power to do that.
You would have power to do that, Your Honor. I would question, however, whether that disposition would be consistent with the Ashwander admonition about not reaching federal constitutional questions unless it's necessary to do so.
Mr. Tolman, is there some evidence in the
Zucchini case, the evidence was, or it was indication that the state courts felt compelled by the federal rules. But here, is there any evidence that Texas feels bound to follow the federal constitution in applying its own?
No, there is no indication that Texas feels bound to follow the federal constitution.
And the Court of Appeals didn't say so.
That's correct. The Court of Appeals treated the state law and federal law
as independent.
And
incidentally, to follow my brother Stephen's suggestion, it's hard to get them to do over again what they've already done.
They've already said
what the state law is.
That is correct.
There's nothing to suggest they change their minds because we decided the federal question one way.
That's exactly correct. They've already decided the state law.
If they're wrong about the federal law, and if they think the state and federal rules are the same, as your opponent argues, now maybe he's wrong, then if we corrected their analysis of federal law, conceivably they could say, well, that means the state law result would be different.
Well, that's all hypothetical, I realize, but it's at least conceivable. But there is nothing in the opinion of the Court of Appeals, I submit, to suggest that they felt that state law and federal law were identical on these issues.
Or different.
Really,
all I do is have a phrase in there saying it violates both provisions.
That's correct. We, however, have cited some state law cases in our brief which indicate that the Texas courts, although they phrase the standards approximately the same as this court does and cite this court's cases, nevertheless reach results which I think this court would not reach on the same facts. So I think that the Texas law is, although it was not analyzed by the Court of Appeals, is not identical with the federal law, and the Court of Appeals did rule on that ground. There are also, I might add, two other grounds of Texas law. One, a Texas common law ground, which the appellee has so far has not been able to get a ruling upon. The Court of Appeals deemed it unnecessary to reach these two other state law grounds, which we argue in our brief. And if this court were to take the case, we would at some point be entitled to an adjudication on those grounds which defend the judgment. And ordinarily, we would be able to argue those grounds to this court because they are grounds for affirmance. This court can affirm on any ground that finds support in the record. So we
that
should
you urged below.
Yes.
That you did urge and they didn't pass.
That's correct. Both were urged below.
Mr. Tone, you say if we were to take the case, probable jurisdiction here was noted in May.
Yes, Your Honor. I was speaking to the supposition suggested in the colloquy with Mr. Justice White, Mr. Justice Brennan, and the Chief Justice that if the court agrees with our position that the appeal should be dismissed for the reason stated earlier and treats the jurisdictional statement as a petition for cert, then it was on that basis that I said if the court takes the case. My view is that the case should not be here on appeal for the reasons I've stated previously.
You would be quite content, I take it, if we held that this was not an appropriate appeal, but treated as cert, we would deny it. I want to be sure that...
Yes, Your Honor. That is the relief we asked for in the first point in the brief.
And just to be sure I understand one point, you're also arguing that unless we treat it as a cert, and if we just act on our noting of probable jurisdiction under 1254-2, you would agree then we don't have the power to listen to your state law arguments.
Then you do not have the power to listen to the state law arguments, but then I submit
then
you don't
say it's
have
unfair,
power to
yeah.
decide the federal question either because your decision would be an advisory one.
Yeah, I understand.
Right. And as to the state law questions the Court of Appeals didn't rule on, it would be unfair to the appellee because we would never have a chance to present those arguments anywhere. Now I should like, although I, as I have said, it's our position that the court should not reach the federal constitutional question. I am sure the court does not want me to argue the Texas law points, and so I think I should proceed to discuss the federal constitutional question as if it were to be reached on this appeal. And I shall proceed to do that. This court has recognized that entertainment is a form of communication and expression protected by the First Amendment. It has also recognized that the communication and expression need not be verbal to be protected. Thus, musical compositions and dancing, including nude dancing, are protected. The First Amendment protects both the right to communicate and the right to receive the communication.
Mr. Tone, do you question that a state could totally outlaw pinball machines which require insertion of coins to operate?
I do question that, Your Honor. I do question that. I think that these games, at least, involve First Amendment expression on the part of the author of the game and on the part of the player of the game. They are complex electronic devices that present a series of audio and visual effects through complex electronic circuitry. They call upon the player to respond.
Who is the author, the mechanic?
Pardon?
Who is the author?
The author, Your Honor, is the person who designs the electronic circuitry.
That's a mechanic.
I think he's more than a mechanic, if the court please. He is, I guess it depends on how broad one's definition of mechanic is, but he's a person skilled in electronics and in the visual and the video arts.
Well, suppose his factory also puts out ad machines. Would they also be protected?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
But the same as the author, they had the same author.
I think an adding machine does not convey a message to anyone.
But the same author. I'm just worried about your word author.
Well, let me call him the originator of the game. He does get a copyright on it. The federal courts have uniformly recognized that these games are protected by copyright.
And so is the adding machine.
I'm not sure about the adding machine. I would not dispute Your Honor's statement, but all right.
More likely a patent, would it not be?
The adding machine might have a patent.
Well, Mr. Tone, supposing that in the electrical antitrust cases, certainly the person who thought up the phase of the moon element of that and the complicated parts of it in the early 60s was putting in a good deal of intellectual input and confiding it to a number of other people who were in the same position as he was. Were their activities protected against the Sherman Act?
Well, Your Honor, I think his right to communicate what he had dreamed up was protected. Their conspiracy was forbidden by other laws, but the right to communicate, I think, would be protected. Our position is that these games do involve communication. They involve a receipt of by the player of the ideas of the designer of the game. The game responds in certain ways, in very complicated ways, to matters that the player does. These are not, the little games I'm describing now are not so-called pinball machines, but those machines which make up most of the market now, audio-video games, which are very complicated affairs. And there is a very complicated interrelationship and interaction between the machine and the player. And I would submit to Your Honor that these are a form of expression and communication. One of the amicus briefs quotes at length from Marshall McLuhan. We have a small quote from his statement about games being communication. And he says, that, speaking of all games generally, that they are a media of communication and that should now be plain. And as media of communication, we submit that they fall within the protection of the First Amendment. Like the composer of a musical composition or a dance, the author of the game has a protected right to present his creation to people who want to receive it, and they have a right to receive the expression.
How about the Red Lion case, where certainly people are communicating, but a government agency is telling them that they have to present the other side, too?
That much is true, but there is a special governmental interest in regulation of speech over the restricted channels available for radio and television transmission.
That's because they're using the public highway, is it not? Is that the rationale of the Red Lion and the related cases?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, is there any other place in this, any place in the city that people under 17 can be entertained?
The record in this case, Your Honor, is very skimpy. But there is an indication that there is one other coin-operated game center in the city, and I think there isn't any real dispute that it's...
Why, certainly reasonable time and place restrictions are available, are legal, are not necessarily invalid anyway.
That's correct, and a reasonable time limitation would be valid here. This regulation...
What about a place limitation?
If it were a zoning ordinance, limiting the places where commercial establishments, including games, could be played, that would be reasonable.
You mean a half mile, prohibiting games a half mile from a school, or that sort of thing?
That might well be reasonable, although that's somebody else's case, and I wouldn't want to concede.
Or prohibiting 17-year-olds to go in and play these machines in a bar room?
I think that would be reasonable for a different reason, because the state has a right to prohibit 17-year-olds from going into a bar,
yeah,
I think.
It would also survive First Amendment analysis.
But remember, the fact that it is a fundamental right does not mean that the state has no power whatsoever to regulate it. It merely means that it must regulate it only based upon a compelling state interest, and that the regulation must be reasonably tailored to protect that interest and must not be unnecessarily intrusive on the fundamental right.
You think that rule applies, that every time, place, and manner restriction has to satisfy that test?
I guess that would be too broad a statement, Your Honor. I don't think it would. But this is more than a time, place, and manner statement or restriction before your court. At the present time, as to youths who are unable to persuade their parents to accompany them, or who cannot, whose parents both work, it's a flat prohibition. They can't play the games at all.
Can one gamble on these games?
No, Your Honor. Gambling is expressly forbidden, and these are not gambling devices under Texas law. There is no, you do not have the old free games arrangement and so on. They are not gambling devices. And one could gamble on the games only in the sense that he could gamble on any competitive.
You could bet on the outcome.
You could bet on the outcome, just as you could bet on on the outcome of the football game or on who can run faster. Some of these games are played by individuals alone. Some are played by more than one or a group of individuals. So it is possible to gamble with the games, but that is not their purpose. And there is no evidence in the record that these games have been used for gambling, and they are not gambling devices under Texas law, which does prohibit gambling devices. I submit that the only distinction that can be made between these games and various other forms of expression, including some that this court has held to be protected, is in their social utility. And that is a matter of a value judgment. It's easy to deprecate or jocularly put down the social utility of various forms of expression, including some this court has held protected. But the court has also held that the level of protection to be given any form of expression does not turn on its importance or its social utility.
Well, how about a charter log contest? Could a state or a city forbid that?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I missed the first part of what you said.
A chug-a-lug contest. Who could chug-a-lug the most glasses of beer?
I guess I would not view that as rising to the level of protected expression. We also...
Maybe some 17-year-olds would disagree with you.
That's possible. Also implicated
Judge
Stone, in this...
these games are very lucrative.
Are very...
Lucrative.
Your Honor is correct.
That even at 25 cents a shot.
Yes, that's correct. They are lucrative. That is to say, the owner and operator of the game collects 25 cents for each play.
Do I understand that more than twice as much money is spent on these in this country today than on motion pictures?
I have read those statistics, Your Honor, and I understand them to be correct.
Powerful speech.
Pardon? It's powerful speech, yes.
Who do you say, in all seriousness, who's doing the speaking there, the player or the... originator.
Well, Your Honor, I think both, because the player has to respond to a great variety of challenges that the game presents, which are invoked by what the player does. So there's an interplay between this computer-programmed game and the player. So it's an expression by the designer of the game, of the idea of the game. And there is interaction by the player to the various numerous variables that are presented by the game. And, of course, the owner and operator of the game, I suppose, is in a position analogous to the movie theater operator. He, too, is in the stream of communication. He's the conduit through which the communication goes.
What about the little one at home? Same kind of machines you have at home now.
It's essentially, Your Honor is correct, it's essentially the same as the video game that you play on the television set, except that it is much more elaborate, it's a heavier,
and much more
durable machine, and more expensive. Exactly, it's much more expensive. The ones that are sold at home, I think, are sold on the order of a few hundred, the cost is a few hundred dollars, while these
and
games...
These machines are several thousand.
That's correct. That is correct. We also have argued in our brief that the right of association is implicated. And the case came here on the question stated in the jurisdictional statement of whether there exists a right of social association. That was the principal issue stated. I submit that there is. This court has, although it hasn't ruled on that point expressly, I submit that there ought to be such a right, just as there is, just as entertainment enjoys First Amendment protection as expression. And in the case at bar, at least the stated purpose of the ordinance is to prohibit young people from congregating. The preamble says, in fact, the congregation of youthful patrons creates problems of policing due to the need to protect the patrons from the influence of those who promote gambling, sale of narcotics, and other unlawful activities. So the purpose of this, although as Justice Stevens points out, it's directed to individual games as well as places where there are more than one game, the stated purpose, is to prevent congregating, which is an exercise of the right of association. The method chosen is to prevent them from playing the games when they get there. So it's perhaps an ineffectual method of preventing congregating, but that is its purpose. I should also like to say, in the few minutes left available, that constitutional guarantees apply to minors as well as adults, that the scope of the particular right may be reduced in the case of a minor by one or more of the factors identified by Justice Powell in Bilotti 2. These factors are taken into account in defining the state interest to justify the regulation limiting a fundamental right. But nevertheless, even though minors are involved, the fundamental right should enjoy the strict scrutiny, the protection of the strict scrutiny test, having in mind that the state may have a stronger interest or a different interest in regulating the conduct of children than adults. But nevertheless, the strict scrutiny test should apply, and the restriction should bear should serve some substantial purpose in regulating the evil to which it's directed, and it should be reasonably limited to the means should be limited to that which is necessary to protect the interest.
How about truancy laws, Mr. Tone, where a group of youth say, we want to congregate at this particular pool hall during school hours rather than go to school?
I would say, Your Honor, that the state's compelling interest in requiring children to attend school is sufficient to justify the truancy law and prohibiting children from congregating elsewhere during school hours. But that doesn't mean that their congregating is not a fundamental right. It just means that that fundamental right has to be balanced against the compelling interest of the state, and in that instance, I believe the state, the compelling interest prevails. As we point out in our brief, if the court agrees that the games involve expression and a fundamental right, then there is, in addition to the fundamental right analysis, strict scrutiny analysis that I have already stated, a similar analysis under the Equal Protection Clause. I think I shall leave to my brief the vagueness issue.
Well, let me just ask you something about that. If you think the issue is moot, which I take it you do. Do you?
No, Your Honor. We've argued that it is not moot.
Why is that?
Well, we say that there is a reasonable expectation of recurrence, and we argue that there is some indication of that from the fact that the city has never seen fit to tell any court that it repealed the old ordinance and replaced it with another one. And the city says it would like to go back to it. Now, that's the...
Well, do you know of any other instances where, in a situation like that, we've recognized this exception to the mootness doctrine, capable of repetition yet evading review? Is that it?
That's it.
I'm
sorry.
What is that?
The tests are under the Los Angeles County case, whether there is any reasonable expectation of recurrence of the violation, or whether events during the pendency of the litigation have completely eradicated the effects of the violation. That's the test of mootness.
Let me ask you, suppose that, however, we disagree with you and say that it's moot. Shouldn't we then, to that extent, vacate the opinions below?
And we dismiss
the case to that extent?
Yeah, we argue that you should not, Your Honor. And the reason is explained in the very last section of our brief. Yeah. That would be the more usual disposition.
If we thought it was moot.
If you thought it was moot, yes.
But unless we do that, if I understand it, the city is now disabled from reenacting the ordinance it wants to act, isn't it? By the Court of Appeals judgment.
That would be correct. The Court of Appeals judgment would stand. The alternatives
are
leaving. So if
we vacate everything, presumably they'll just reinstate it.
That would be that they would be free to reinstate the ordinance all over again, and they apparently would like to do that. So I think there is a good reason to treat this as the exceptional case in which a determination of mootness should not result in the vacating of the judgment of the Court of Appeals.
Well, it really isn't. It's a jurisdictional question. It's a case or controversy question.
I think the question of whether this court decides the case is a case or controversy question. The question of whether this court leaves standing a judgment of the Court of Appeals is not in our submission.
Well, I don't know. The Court of Appeals judgment isn't final.
We have to do something. We've noted probable jurisdiction, so we have to do something with the case.
That judgment isn't final, and it's moot.
You could dismiss the appeal on the ground the issue is moot, Your Honor. We're speaking now of the vagueness issue. But there's nothing then there's nothing then for the Court of Appeals judgment to operate on. The issue it decided is gone.
There's nothing for it to operate on but the ordinance that was in existence. And at least there is a determination that that ordinance, which has now been replaced, was void for vagueness. So at least the city can't reenact that ordinance.
Well, so you think that our practice of vacating moot judgments in moot cases is just prudential?
I think it is prudential, yes.
Would your first option take care of all these problems?
What about that?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Your first option that you argued today.
The first option would take all care of all of the problems except for the vagueness issue. The first option takes care of the age restriction. On the vagueness issue, I would submit that the court, if it determines that the case is moot, since the ordinance is no longer in existence, would then simply has to decide whether to vacate the judgment or simply dismiss the appeal. We argue in our brief, and I do not, of course, have time to argue it here, that the judgment is not moot because it meets the tests of the Los Angeles County case.
Very well. Do you have anything further, Mr. Archer? You have a few minutes.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. I don't agree that counsel's idea of how the case may be treated is the only alternatives either to dismiss the appeal and then deny certiorari or grant it. I think this court could remand the case back to the district court or to the Court of Appeals for a clarification as to whether they are making a decision based upon an independent state ground or whether they consider the provisions identical. I think that it would be a terrible thing if the case does go off on that point, because even though you're reviewing a judgment and not an opinion, that opinion of the Court of Appeals is in the books. And that means that the cities throughout the Fifth Circuit that desire to have this type of ordinance, whether there's any diversity jurisdiction between the their operators in the city or not, are going to be harmed by this opinion on the books, assuming, of course, that you disagree with it. Of course, if you agree with the opinion, I assume that that would become the law of the land, and it wouldn't make any difference in which circuit you were in. But assuming that you did disagree with the opinion of the court, but you felt that you must deny certiorari, then, as I say, I don't think that's the only alternative. I think it can be remanded back for clarification as to whether or not this was an independent state ground or whether it was just mere verbiage to the effect that, yes, the state constitution is similar to the federal constitution. I think the overriding question was federal law, and I think that's how the Court of Appeals decided the case, based on the level of review to be accorded this type of activity.
Can I ask you what you, under your view, if this problem of state-federal law had been threshed out more fully in the Court of Appeals during argument, which should have based the decision on state law or federal law, if it had to choose between the two?
Well, I think they could have based it on both, all right, if they...
No, but if they have to choose, they decide they ought to take one. Is there a doctrine they should take the state law ground in order to avoid the unnecessary decision of federal constitutional question?
I would think that they should, yes. I think this court does that, and I would think that the Court of Appeals, maybe they're not required to, but I would think that would be a proper disposition. But I don't think it was their intent to determine that there was separate state and federal law. I think they just mentioned that, yes,
no, they surely just cited federal cases except for one state case that had nothing to do with the issue.
Yes, I think that's correct.
Yeah.
There's plenty of room in the
I will yield the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in...